Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of Percepta Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, Game Wisdom site designer and artist for Smoked Games, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And our guest this week is fan of the site and programmer, Will Long.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Will, you're just a little bit low again.
Sorry about that.
There you go. All right, so I know it's probably been a busy week for everyone. How has everyone's week been going?
Pretty fast, actually. There's a lot of things going through. It's already almost Friday, so yeah. And I still have all my work done.
Yeah, I know. Seems like the days are just going really quick now. I've been trying to get work done with the site and just doing some other projects at the moment. And of course, I have the big Doctor Who show to watch in a few days.
Oh, wow. You're just out of interest?
No, I've been following it for the last year now, so I'm pretty excited to see what they're doing for the 50th on Saturday.
Oh, nice.
Let's begin then with some news this week. And I guess what always seems to be in the news is whenever Anita Sarkeesian puts out a new video for Women versus Tropes in the Video Game Industry, or Tropes versus Women, that's the actual title. So we're up to number 4 now in her series. And this one she is talking about what she's dubbed the Miss Male character. So the video is about characters in video games who are basically the female equivalent of the male. So essentially, it's the male, you know, same personality, same basic design, but with some kind of a gender qualifier or something to signify that this is the female and this is the male type deal. So from this series, I think that this is probably her most, I guess, realized video. Seems like this is the one that she makes some pretty good arguments about. But I still have some issues with the beginning of it. She spends the first, I think, 6-7 minutes of the video talking about Pac-Man and Miss Pac-Man. Mm-hmm. And how Pac-Man, of course, is designed as the yellow oval. And Miss Pac-Man was designed as the same exact thing, but with a bow on top. And this is one of those points that I'm not sure if this is just, you know, my bias versus her bias, but when she's talking about how this is, you know, against women and something that they did just to spark interest, I just see more as a general business consideration, because when we're talking about a game like Pac-Man, this is 80s technology, 80 graphics, so they really couldn't do a lot with it. And I think no matter what they would have done to pretty much make that character, I think she probably would have found a problem with it. What do you guys think?
Well, there's a lot of, first of all, the 80s itself was full of exploitations, you know, the rise of focus groups, all that kind of stuff. And you're right. I mean, yes, games are now seen as an art form to a degree, but in the 80s, they were just toys like anything else to be marketed, and they wanted to get the female demographic. So they decided to, you know, just put a bow on Pac-Man and say, hey, we have another game. Not only do we have another game to sell, right, but we also can bring in the girls and say games are girls friendly, you know? It's a bit, if you think about it, It's a double-edged sword, right? Like, yes, you're bringing in more girls, but you're also, you know, exploiting them, per se, because it is, like, the same kind of, it is the same game,
yeah.
You know? So they're just pretty much paying twice for the same game. People like at Pac-Man is Pac-Man.
Yeah, now, she's arguing that these characters are not designed well because they're pretty much, you know, the female equivalent of the male. But again, I think this sort of goes back to one of the main criticisms against her pieces, is that she's viewing this completely from the women's perspective, but a lot of the games that she draws examples from and that she shows, the male characters are also pretty much underrepresented as well. Now, that's not to say that this is not an issue, but when she pulls examples from games where, you know, the male is as underdeveloped as the female, I think that really undercuts her argument. What do you think?
Oh, definitely, because I mean, like a game like Skyrim, right? You can pick a girl or a guy. It doesn't change that much. Mm-hmm. But that's because the character itself is supposed to be an avatar for you, mm-hmm. whoever you want to be, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, games like Dragon Age 2 versus Dragon Age 1. Dragon Age 1, you create the character, you are the character. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have a voice or anything and just reflects exactly, you know, how you created them. But in Dragon Age 2, you know, even though you're actually more into playing an actual role. Where you have a character, you pick decision, they just say whatever. Like, if you pick the topic of hats, you might go on a tirade about how much you hate hats, but, you know, you don't have any sort of control of it. It's that character's perspective on the choice made. While Dragon Age 1 is pretty much a cut and dry, your choice is your choice. You know, this is exactly what you said kind of thing.
Now, speaking about Dragon Age and generally BioWare, she also mentioned Mass Effect as pretty much her modern-day example of this type of trope, and she referred to the male shepherd versus the quote-unquote femme shep, and how that they had to qualify shepherd as a female, calling her femme shep, but that there's no qualifier for the male. And I think her argument was that the game was built primarily for the male audience and marketed as such. And then sort of like they, you know, squeezed in having a female character later on in the series.
I don't even know. Like, that game is, again, in front of those games where you kind of create your own character. It's more like Dragon Age 2, actually. But, well, that's because Dragon Age 2 was influenced by Mass Effect. But in that aspect, I actually always played a female character throughout the entire series. It wasn't even, even though it was they marketed with the male character, I still picked the female character. Mostly because the delivery and voice acting of the female character was much, much better than the male character.
Yeah. And as we mentioned this in an earlier cast, she was voiced by the excellent Jennifer Hale.
Exactly. So you have a very experienced veteran doing it, and I understand why they did the male demographic. Because if you look, again, you have to pull in business number statistics. Mm-hmm. Your demographic's still mostly male that plays the game, played the originals, played the sequels. So, you know, you want to play it safe. But, I mean, I think that they at least put an inclusion of the female character is actually good, because she does stand on her own. She's not a flip of it. Because, again, her delivery, her swagger, like the way that she views, the way she discusses, and the different types of choices you make is based on your gender. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, and when I actually got Mass Effect 3, I flipped the box art, so it was FemShep. Because that's who represented me.
Now, I think that's an interesting point about how the game was marketed, because this is one of those sort of catch-22 situations, I think, when we talk about women in the video game industry, where we talk about how games are still marketed as men, and we want to see a greater diversity in terms of not only marketing, but, you know, less of the misogynistic point of view. But on the flip side, when people look at numbers and you look at who's buying video games, it's still an 18 to, you know, 25 or 26 range male who play video games.
Right. But, I mean, the trend is changing, right? The casual market is mostly female, actually. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely there. And I think that as time goes on, games are getting more and more accepted as more than just a toy, but like a pastime, you know, like a hobby mm-hmm. for people. And it's less that barrier that was there before is starting to be broken down as, you know, geek and nerd culture is seeping into the mainstream. And games being a big part of that, and plus being hella fun, I'm sure that I think that our, you know, future children will also enjoy games without that weird stigma that games are for losers only.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and go ahead. Also, even the adults, like, you know, I hear my friends nowadays, they say, like, if their boss are, like, playing, you know, this most popular game called Candy Crush, you know, while working. So, you know, it's not just losers, you can say anymore. It's like, it's kind of like casual for like everyone.
Right. And that there's a big reason for that boom. Mostly, I say it's the Wii and mobile devices becoming, you know, everyone getting smartphones, right? And the boom of app developers. Mm-hmm. And there are always a casual market. Like, Max has made The Sims, and that was like the biggest game, the highest PC selling game at one point in time.
Mm-hmm. And one part of her piece I was a bit concerned that she had mentioned was about Call of Duty, the latest one. There was this big discussion about that they're finally introducing a female soldier into the mix. And from what I saw of like cutscenes and just like the general news battle, it just seemed like they were just copying and pasting a woman in the game. And I thought that would probably have been a good example to support her argument that they're, you know, just copying and pasting the genders to create these different characters.
I don't think that is, I mean, that's definitely a great example, but I think the video was made before that the game came out, so that's probably why. That is the perfect example of what she's discussing.
Yeah. And that, to me, is one of those examples that I really don't like to hear, because that, to me, it doesn't sound like they're doing it to promote more women playing the video game. It sounds like they're doing it more just to check off a list and make sure that women are happy kind of deal. It's like, it's not really a focus, it's just, you know, they're just trying to appease a certain audience.
Right. And I guess, I wonder if she still believes that there is a missed male character, say, like there's, like, example, let's say Golden Axe, right? You know, even though they have similar attacks, their magic is different, so they're definitely, they feel like separate characters. There's a lot of game characters where there's male and females where their movesets are different, hence making them different characters. Yet, they are visually a Miss Male character. Mm-hmm. So does that still count?
She kind of said it does when she brought up Donkey Kong Country when they introduced Dixie Kong into the game. She basically saw Dixie as the female equivalent of Diddy Kong, even though Dixie featured a different moveset. She was able to do like that sort of hover ability or that glide when she jumps power.
Right, and then she shoots it up. And yeah, it feels different, the play of it. I mean, you can reach the same points if you're skilled enough, but I feel like this has to be different. Though she is, I mean, how much personality are you going to... That's something that's a little more hard to discuss, because they're not that like fleshed out of characters. They're just, you know, a lot of personalities comes from their little dances at the end, beginning. And, you know, their animations. Is that, I don't think it's really fair to kind of put that on her.
I think that's an argument that we've talked about in earlier videos when we looked at them, is that one of the major criticisms against her videos, especially when she's focusing on older games, like I would say Nintendo 64 and before, is that a lot of these games weren't meant to be story-based. They weren't meant to be examined that critically. They were designed simply to promote a specific gameplay style, and then everything else was sort of put into that very quickly. So it's not like these designers were explicitly making, you know, women look bad or making the man has to save the woman. They were just trying to figure out, okay, we're making this game about sword fighting. How are we going to do this, you know, quick and dirty story type deal?
Right, and I don't even see Dixie Kong as a negative, you know, push to tropes. But, you know, that's, I mean, does she make some good points, though? Because I'm sure there's an inkling in there, the developers, that they need some sort of female representation. This is a good chance to do that. And looking at her character design, it's, you know, she has a lot of very, you know, general female traits that they put on, they slap onto a character. Long hair, pink.
Yeah. And I think that's one of her points as well, is that when you make a male character, you don't really have any gender identifiers for your males, but they're shown more and more on female characters. She brought up one of the characters from the Super Mario games, one of the Koopa kids, the only female on that, and like how she designs, you know, she's got the big pink bow in her hair, long eyelashes, long fingernails, giant lips. And so that is pretty much, you know, very clearly a female. While the other characters look, while they're male, they're more, I guess, diversified. So you can really tell apart their characters beyond just saying that, oh, he's a male, he's a male.
Yeah, I think this problem pervades more than just games, but any, like, movies and television series, too. When you said that, I thought of Gremlins. There's only one female gremlin in Gremlins 2, and she has, like, big lips, and she's wearing a dress. And I'm like, what?
And I think that's where she makes a good point, that there really aren't as many well-defined female characters as there are male. And so that's why I think this is probably one of her stronger videos, because her point really does stand, especially with modern games. Now, she did bring up one good point that we talked about, is how there's a lot more diversity in the indie market than there is in the AAA. And that with indie games, we see a lot more examples of female characters who aren't, you know, designed as overly, you know, over-the-top female.
Right, but she did get angry at Scribblenauts, didn't she, for having, you know,
yeah,
female character?
Yeah, there's only... I honestly don't know if that's accurate or not. I know there's a lot of male characters. I know that in the one that I play, there was a female one, but I can't for the life tell you that if every one of the characters was male or not. So I'm just going to have to go by what she said on that.
Yeah, and I think that that's what she hopes for a lot of her videos, that no one actually goes and researches this kind of stuff anyways. But I think she does make a good point in this video just for the idea that this is a problem and something that we do and something that we accept as normal, right? A male, then, like, you know, a tacked-on female option for people that want to play a girl.
Yep, and also about how marketing to resort to these games is always hyper-masculine.
Right, and again, even though you have a female character in it, she's probably seen more as some sort of eye candy than, you know, represented in the box art, like, equivalent to, like we talked about this before, Bioshock Infinite versus Last of Us. Bioshock Infinite, Elizabeth is, like, a main star, yet she's not on it at all. It's just Booker looking down with a gun.
With, like, you know, some kind of, like, fire on his arm.
Yeah, and I'm like, that's not what people expected or wanted. Go ahead.
Have you guys ever even noticed, like, there's some games out there where when you compare a guy and a girl of, like, similar classes, where the girl would have would be better in terms of magic as opposed to the guy, where that he would be better in terms of strength?
Yeah, that, I think, falls back to the D&D days, if I remember what people were telling me about. That back then, when they were designing, like, the monster manuals and stuff for Dungeons & Dragons, males always had higher strength and constitution, while the women always had higher int and...
Dexterity?
Yeah, int or... Yeah, that's probably it.
That's actually a real-life fact, that women are more dexterous than males. Mm-hmm. I think at least the D&D that I played, actually haven't played, I'm more like, I play D&D through games actually. So most of the times I pick a male and female, there's actually no difference in terms of the stats. It's only when you base it on race.
I know with XCOM, there is literally no difference between the males and the females in the game. Every character is represented by their class and two stats, but they're not basically resigned to either gender. It's willpower and accuracy.
And they have the same armor and everything. There's no, like heavy armor with boobs attached to it, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's not exploitive, it's straight up. And that's something we discussed, too, is that when we see girls in games that are usually tacked on, I mean, while the males have, like, a good example is, like, that MMO, Terra, is that what it's called?
Oh, there's too many MMOs like that.
Well, there's an MMO.
The recent one, right?
Mm-hmm, Terra.
Yeah, Terra.
The one with, like, action-based, like, more like, action, not turn-based kind of gameplay.
Yeah.
The guys have heavy set armor, but the girls have heavy set armor. It's pretty much the thong. Mm-hmm. I'm impressed that even in this current, our current times and this generation, that we still have that hardcore amount of exploitation. I'm like, really?
Oh, have you seen that game Crimson something? It's like a game from Korea. And I don't even want to dare, type that.
No, this is a little like, I'm not trying to be racist or anything, but I feel like a lot of older games were made by Japanese developers, and they wanted to generalize or help, mm-hmm. they need to help, like, ultra characterize, their player character, and make sure that it's has universal appeal. So that's why they did the exaggerations of, like, ribbons and pink and dresses and stuff on their characters. And I think they're, one of the root causes too. I mean, we do it too, but they did it more because that's what the character designers did.
There was a piece in the news, I think a month or so ago, about a upcoming first person shooter, like a military one, that they're going to have the women designed differently based on what nationality the game is aimed for. I can't remember what game it was. Was it Battlefield or was it another one?
I don't think it's either of the big ones. But yeah, just to go back to my original argument. So Bioshock Infinite and Last of Us. Last of Us decided to have Ellie, the main character, right front center of the box art. It represented the game a lot better than, Bioshock Infinite's, where the reason why he didn't have Elizabeth put her on the back was because he wanted to broaden his demographic to everyone he could. If it is the frat boys, then so be it. At least they're open to a new genre.
Yeah, and that goes back to the whole art versus business category. And it's something that we see a lot of developers. We've spoken to several indie developers who talk about how much they hated that kind of compromise and why they moved to the indie market. And as you just said with Ken Levine, he had to basically decide, do I make my core audience happy, but at the risk of, losing all these sales and perhaps killing the series, or do I take this slight hit, but hopefully expand the game to the point that I can make more for my fans?
Right. And, I mean, I think that business-wise, it was a better decision. But if he really as an artistic vision, he should have not have compromised on it. But again, like, what's so big about box art? Because it's getting diminished as we have more digital downloads.
Yeah, that's true. I did look it up, and I did find the game that I was thinking of. It's called Warface. It's by Crytek, the guys who did Far Cry and Crysis.
Huh?
And what they're doing is that they're basically, for each of the female models, they're designing them differently based on the nationality they're aiming for. So the exaggerated woman for the Russian version of the game is going to look different than the exaggerated female version for the Chinese version of the game.
Okay.
And that's pretty weird that they're, instead of, trying to design a accurate female, they're basically trying to appeal to each nationality. As you were just mentioning with business, that's in terms of like a business point of view, that's pretty smart. But
you're also using more assets, though. You're also creating more assets and more time for your artists and programmers.
And again, it seems like a lot more work, and it goes back to the whole Miss Male type figure, because all they're doing is changing the assets to make, a very exaggerated female model, but they were doing it for each different nationality that they're aiming for.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's similar to, I remember there was a game called EverQuest 2. There was the Western characters, which looked pretty ugly, and then there had the Eastern characters, which they're all a lot closer to anime, slick faces, that kind of set, et cetera, et cetera, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's just like different versions of beauty, right? Or aesthetics, mm-hmm. and that's why they do it. But I think for this one, it's purely a money decision.
Yeah, and...
Until we see the actual character models.
And I bet one strong argument against this is, of course, the fact that I bet they're not doing the same for the male characters. I bet they're just going to figure the same male asset for each nationality they're releasing the game for.
Well, yeah. Maybe women still mystify them.
All right. So I think we can move on. Do you guys have any final things you want to say about the Miss Male video?
I just don't want her teaching this stuff in class. That's it. Go on.
So, I have a piece of news, but I'll talk about that later. Ken, Will, do you want to go next in terms of game news?
I could give you an update on my Kickstarter. So, the one project I talked about last week, the tactile haptics, which is the feedback device, is similar to like a rumble pack, but it allows you to actually have the feeling that you're actually controlling whatever device you're holding. So, if you're holding like a sword or like a flail, you actually feel some weight behind it. That project had a very rough last week where everything went down. In fact, they lost money during that week. And I think a big thing, as I said before, was it's not wireless. And everyone before that bought the STEM, which is a wireless version of the Hydra, which is, you know, it's a better version of the Hydra, and it's wireless. So everyone always spent money on that. And also everyone spent money on the Oculus. People spent money on the Omni treadmill. So people have a lot of fatigue right now, I would say. And to pay the cost of pretty much another STEM, because again, the cheapest one is $150 or $160 actually, mm-hmm. Just for, you know, extra feedback. I don't think only enthusiasts can probably buy it. So that extreme high cost, really made them, that really detracted their campaign. Mm-hmm. That and, I think that they realized that, and they actually did like damage control all this week. So they actually sent out surveys and got everyone's opinion. And it seems like, again, and I'm happy that they're actually going to make their device wireless, sorta, where they have like a wire coming out of the controller, and you have to put like the a battery pack in your pocket or something.
Do you have any idea when they were originally pitching this that it was going to be a wire, or you?
I asked the question multiple times in the forums. They said it were going to be wired all the way for the Kickstarter. But they decided, because of all this backlash, that they decided to make a stretch goal, their first stretch goal, $100,000 extra to make it wireless. I'm like, whoa, guys, it's already a niche device. So
I think this is one of those cases where it would have been better to hold off and develop the wireless prototype and pitch that as the Kickstarter.
Yeah, if they would have said this is the wireless version and then launched like that, they would have made a lot more money. People would have impulse buy that, even if it was 160 or whatever, or a higher cost, they would have impulse buy it for two, to go with the STEM, right? The perfect companion. Mm-hmm. And the video was really good, and it's just that cost was so high, and it wasn't wireless. And I got the wired version specifically because I was going to use it for development to buy the consumer version, which was said to be wireless and cheaper. So, again, I really want to make a post and maybe discuss it and try to get some more funding, because I'd really want to see them succeed. And it is really great technology. And again, like after, like, what, 20 years, all we have are rumble packs. That's all we got. Like, something hits us, we have a little rumble. This is an actual device that simulates what's happening in the virtual world, in the real world. It's more like if you tested it, you'd be a believer kind of thing, you know?
I still say that all these guys should just pool their resources and just create that virtual reality system from the Lawnmower Man. That should be like the next logical step for all this.
No, that's way too costly. Too many moving parts. You know that.
Oh, yes.
But I'm just saying, like, for like $1,000, you could get a whole VR set now with all the Kickstarters and stuff. Mm-hmm. Before, it would cost you $200,000 to get just the device, just the head-mounted display.
Yeah.
So we've come a long way, and I hope that the VR revolution keeps going.
Yep, we shall see how this really does play out in the next 7 years, because this decade has been very advanced in terms of the video game industry. We saw the indies rise up, digital distribution has become very much the standard now for game releases. So, I mean, this is a really good time for innovation.
The only thing that I like to see fail in our industry is Origin. Still think it's a crappy service. So hopefully that will shrivel and die soon enough. I just feel bad that if I want to buy a Dragon Age 3, I'm gonna have to download Origin. Oh my god.
Well, Games for Windows Live is looks like it is on its way out. A
Is
lot
dead.
yet more games are being patched out. I know Batman, Arkham Asylum, and Arkham Cities did it. BioShock 2 did it. I'm just really concerned about Dark Souls, because a lot of people are talking about it when Games for Windows Live goes, will Dark Souls stop working multiplayer-wise?
That's a good question. Probably.
Hopefully they'll get Dark Souls 2 out by then. Because I have read piece that Dark Souls 2 is being developed for the PC first, and then saw a port to the consoles, as opposed to Dark Souls 1 was console first, and then ported to the PC.
You know, that would make more sense, because both the new devices are PC architecture. So, there you go.
Will, do you have any news you want to bring up?
No big news at the moment.
Okay. The other piece I want to talk about sort of goes with my interview with Good Old Games. And Good Old Games, I'm not sure if I mentioned this before in the cast, but it's one of those concepts I've always wanted to have, but I wasn't really sure we would ever get that ability to basically have an archive for classic video games that are able to run on modern computers. Now, GOG is, I believe, 5 years old this year, and they've pretty much gone a long way. So for both of you guys, did you like ever think that GOG would be able to survive? Like, the whole idea of basically repackaging and selling classic games, I remember when it was first announced, some people were like, you know, this isn't going to work, or who's really going to buy it?
Well, I was a big believer of it, just because that just seemed to have all the old games that I wanted. They just had a good amount of games, but I was looking for the other alternatives. It's similar to when I check out Netflix and Hulu and other video services. They don't have it all, then someone else will have the alternate. And I think that their business plan was just is you know, I think they just saw the opportunity and said, hey, we can do digital distribution, but we can actually pick up these old games, get these rights, and then we can make them work for newer computer systems, because again, a lot of these old games don't work on new systems, and there's issues with drivers and frame rate issues, VSync, and all that stuff, you know, that hurts these old games. So I'm really great that not only are they revitalizing these old games, but they're finding an audience for people that love the nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and it's kind of interesting how they do add the value to these old games. One, by keeping the cost relatively low. I think outside of, like, you know, the big name ones like System Shock, Baldur's Gate, most of their games on there are like between $5 and $9, and they of course include PDFs of the manual and any of like the bonus features you would see in the original retail packaging.
Oh, I love that. They do have wallpapers and they have music. Mm-hmm. It's one of those like extra bonus gifts that you didn't expect that you just, you know, love. So yeah. Another cool thing GOG does, they make it really easy to get that stuff too. While when Steam has extra things to their games, you had to go through like 40 menus to get to it.
And as you said about them pretty much, you know, servicing this niche, I think that's a really good point, because as you said, a lot of these older games, yes, you could find them on abandonware sites, you could find them freeware and stuff like that, but to get them to run on modern computers is a whole nother story. Some place you have to download specific emulators, you gotta tweak files and all that stuff. And part of GOG's service is the fact that they basically make it as simple as you click the game and it loads up fine. You don't have to worry about anything else.
Yeah, and don't forget, all of them are DRM-free. Mm-hmm. All of them. So Windows, games for Windows, don't need that. Mm-hmm. You know, you're assured that you can just, you know, install it and play it, and that's it.
And they've been, that's one of their pretty much cornerstones of the service, is DRM-free. And that also transitioned to when they started releasing modern day games on the servers, and when they officially redubbed themselves from Good Old Games to GOG.
Right. And plus, you know, it's GOG itself is easier to say. Mm-hmm. So
now, one part of their business strategy, which I find very interesting, is the number of sales they have on the site. Because their games are relatively inexpensive to begin with. But I think we've mentioned this before, it is kind of weird spending, you know, $5 to $10 on a 15-year-old game.
But at the same time, everyone's lost their boxes. They moved around. You know, it's they see it and they pull on their nostalgia strings, you know? Like when I saw Undying, I purchased it on the day it came out. I'm like,
yeah,
yes, I want this game. I want to play it. I remember it fondly. And I never finished it. Mm-hmm. So, and the box is long gone. Vampire Redemption, I beat that game but I still want to go back to it and see, like, why did I have fond memories of it? Why did I love it so much? And, you know, that's what I've done, and I've realized it's pretty dated, but it's still a nostalgia trip for me.
Yeah.
And,
go ahead.
I mean, like, nowadays, $5-$10 is relatively cheap, like, cheap enough in the mindset that people will, you know, will want to purchase that game. You know, back in the old days, games that you'll see there, when you were younger, they would probably be like $20, $30, $40 even.
Oh, it's 50 all the way, usually.
So, you know.
Yeah, there's ways to, or like, couldn't get those games when I was younger because I could only buy so many games, or I was too young to get the games too. Is another reason why I like GOG, to kind of revisit these games that I always were interested in. But I think you're right about the low cost thing, because I think it's low enough that they're all in the impulse buy range, you know. So that's another cool thing about it. I mean, at least for them.
And they run a lot of sales, and they've been pretty much changing their sales strategies over the years. Before, it was just like during the winter time. I remember one year they just pretty much said, "Okay, every game's on sale. The entire catalog's on sale. Go with it." And now they've been moving to weekly sales. They just had this incredibly brilliant sale, I think a week ago, the Fall Insomnia sale, where they're basically selling limited sales copies of games. And it was pretty much first come, first serve, and they pretty much, I think they sold out every one of their games within like 5 hours, so then they just kept it going with like random games. It was pretty fun.
Yeah, I think people just like, and people love deals. They like perceived value, yeah. Right? So when they see sales, they got to do it. They feel like they're missing out if they don't. And I think that's a big thing, is that people just have too many games to play. They just want to have it just in case they have the time to play it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I got my little library here that, you know, maybe someday I'll be able to actually get around to play.
Yeah, and I'm still finishing like 5 games right now, including the 3 GOG games. Like, I've been going through GOG, through all the old adventure games. And, you know, I'm trying things out like Broken Sword, and trying things out like, I have no mouths and I must scream. Those kind of things. So it's interesting to go back to these adventure games that everyone's talked about and actually give them a shot.
I mean, that doesn't always happen either, because, you know, sometimes even though you get this whole list of backlogs, and you're like, yeah, I'm going to play it someday, and then you see this amazing game that everyone's playing, and then all of a sudden you decide to buy this game, and you just play that game.
Well, yeah, that's a sign of at least addictive or well-designed game, if it keeps you coming back over your other catalogs. So.
And one thing that I love from the interview is when I ask the PR guy from GOG about why does he feel so many people are drawn to the games, even though a lot of them could be considered dated, he said that a lot of the games back then, they were designed with a lot more creativity because they weren't designed to appeal to everyone. As you mentioned, Ken, earlier in the cast, the 80s and the 90s for like mainstream games was about the focus group testing, about trying to appeal to everyone at one time. And a lot of the classic games, they were just designed by a small team wanting to make a game that they wanted to play. And you can definitely see that quality and that creativity in these titles.
Yeah, and like, again, there are a lot of these interfaces are pretty hardcore. I'm like,
yeah.
Wow, this would never pass. This is so asinine. You don't need to have all these options, right? It's not streamlined at all. And because of that, I'm sure a lot of people saw these games and were just deterred by it.
And it's sort of like that push and pull between accessibility and depth. A lot of these classic games are very, very deep. But at the same time, unless you have, you know, hours to read through the manuals and fight these interfaces, you're not going to be able to get that enjoyment out of the game compared to games today where, pretty much thanks to standardized control schemes, it's a lot easier to jump into a game.
Right. I mean, and there's a lot more hand-holding, you know? Mm-hmm. They're scared of losing their audience. But yeah, go back and play one of these old games in GOG and just see how quickly you get frustrated.
Oh yeah. Especially like I would love like someone who loves like the BioWare games now to go back and play, you know, like Might and Magic 1.
Or even going back to you know, like Neverwinter Nights or the Baldur's Gate series. Like, man, I love those kind of games, but I try to play Baldur's Gate, I'm like, I can't. I just can't. it's just too random and micromanaging. But I'm gonna try again to play Baldur's Gate 2 or Baldur's Gate 1.
And
I think like one of the indies game, Super Meat Boy, is very good at bringing back, you know, some of that toughness into the game as well. You know, from all the, what you were saying earlier about how the earlier games, yes, they're, most of them were very frustrating too, but they, you know, they kind of bring you back into that, you know, 80s and 90s feel.
Or, you know, that nice balance of challenge and, you know, fun, you know?
And as we were talking about a few minutes ago with Kickstarters and pretty much how creative things are getting today, this is a really great time to bring back those classic games thanks to Kickstarter, where you can basically create a game that you want with having a nice budget thanks to crowdfunding, but you're not being pressured by a publisher to make your game mainstream. And I think that has sort of been the catalyst for a lot of these really successful Kickstarters like Double Fine, Project Eternity, Shadowrun, and a whole lot of others.
Yeah, again, so I love seeing this revival, and I that's another thing is Kickstarter is, again, I'm a big fanboy of Kickstarter, is because, you know, not only are you getting a game that you want, right, but you're also doing a charity for developers that really deserve it too.
Yep. So as we've been talking, I've been looking at my GOG catalog, and just like with Steam, there are games on here that I don't actually remember buying. I have in my collection. So I'm looking at, right now, I have 115 games on GOG. What do you have, Ken?
How do you check the tally? Look for the numbers.
If you go to My Games and you look all the way at the top of the cabinet, it shows, like, all and then the number.
Oh, 51. Oh, wow. So you're beating me. Oh, you're still beating me.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a couple of interesting games I just bought. I Have No Mouth, I Must Scream, Pathologic, and Sanitarium.
I bought the Tex Murphy game Under a Killing Moon. Startopia, and oh yeah, I bought Chronicles of Riddick. I know that's on Steam, but this one, of course, as we just said, has no DRM attached to it, so that's really nice.
Cool.
And I still haven't played like so many games on here, like Dark Vault 2. I don't remember buying that. I bought that Leisure Suit Larry game like 3-4 months ago. I still haven't gotten around to that. And I must have like close to like 300-400 hours worth of RPGs just with all the games on GOG alone.
Actually, there's one game I did finish on my GOG collection. That was Defender Quest, but that was like a recent indie game that came out.
So it's going to be interesting to see what GOG is going to do in the future. I've tried to get the information out of him in the interview, and he sort of, you know, just winked and said, you know, stay tuned.
Well, I'm very excited. I think they're doing pretty well, and you know, they had a lot of deals where if you buy this, you get The Witcher for free, or The Witcher 2 for free. And if you think about that, not only are they giving you free stuff, but at the same time, they're strengthening their brand and getting new fans, right? Mm-hmm. It's a good idea. And I think there's a lot of hype and a lot of expectations for Witcher 3. I think with their funds, I think they'll be fine. Mm-hmm. They have full control over it.
Yeah. And especially one of the great things about the site is they have a community feature where you can vote on what games you want to see them basically go after first. That's pretty much how Clive Barker's Undying got on the service, was people, enough people voted for that game, and they eventually got it from EA.
Oh, totally worth it. Look, everyone wants Grim Fandango. I would love to see Grim Fandango, and, oh, Diablo, too.
Yep.
Looking at the wish list, Diablo and Grim Fandango's on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when I first was like going, maybe I'll request some games on that. I'm sure, you know, no one's gotten around to it. And then every game that I thought that I wanted to vote for, people I've already had on their wanted list.
Yeah, it looks like the top ones are Diablo, Grim Fandango, and No One Lives Forever, which I have not played. I'll look that up.
Yeah, I never played No One Lives Forever either, but I heard that's a really good game. And incidentally, they say it's one of the best examples of a female lead character.
Oh yeah, it looks like it. Looks like it's a 60s throwback.
Mm-hmm. There's so many games on here. And, you know, as long as they're still having classic games and now they're going for modern indie games, they pretty much aren't going to run out of games to put on. But
definitely not.
I do think it's interesting, though. I think when we talked with Chris Park and how they haven't been going after GOG as one of the places for Arkane games, is that GOG isn't a fan of DLC or having to buy expansions and stuff like that. They basically like their games to be, you know, you buy the game and that's it. There's no DLC, no additional content, stuff like that.
Makes sense. And plus, they keep their rep high then, too.
Yep.
Legitimately just for the gamer.
Now, I do wonder, though, because people, as you just mentioned, people are asking for, like, Diablo on the service, there's StarCraft. That would be pretty crazy if GOG actually secures, you know, Blizzard's titles.
If they were to do Diablo, I mean, I'm sure they're not making money on Diablo right now. Come on.
But, you know, Diablo 2 is still huge.
Yep. People still buy that freaking chest, or whatever it's called.
The war chest.
Yep, war chest.
Yeah, but they do that for each one of their games. There's theme park on here. If so, it'd be definitely crazy to see just where they're going to go, because I honestly can't think where else can they go in terms of expanding the brand other than just getting more games.
And again, there's a lot of games I've never even heard of, but I just read the premise. I was like, I'm going to give it a shot. Like Desperados and Safe House Diaries and stuff like that. So it's an interesting mix to see what I've missed in my life, you know, because you only have so much time to play so many games when you're younger. So now I can actually catch up and see them in an adult perspective.
Yep. All right. Let's move on then. And I think we can talk about the discussion for the week. So the piece I want to bring up is about pre-orders. So this is the post I wrote about how pre-ordering games has become more of a debate as we're seeing more and more developers, you know, trying to get people to pre-order games, you know, with bonuses, day one content, season passes, stuff like that. And as I mentioned in the post, pre-ordering in the original form was pretty much the only way to secure your game. I mean, raise your hand if you ever went to EB or GameStop and they said, did you pre-order the game? And nope, we don't have a copy. You haven't pre-ordered. And that was pretty much true for 80s, 90s, and probably the first half of the last decade. But as digital distribution, as we've talked about, changed things around, it pretty much changed how games were released. Suddenly, you weren't limited to your store. You could go to a website and there's essentially an infinite amount of copies of the game. And that really changed things around, because I, like most people, I remember having to spend days driving to and from different EBs to find, you know, which one has a copy of the game that I want. So when pre-orders have been declining, more and more developers are trying to sweeten the deal. We're seeing stores offer pre-order bonuses. You see this with every game release on GameStop has, you know, a GameStop exclusive bonus, you know, 40 minutes of new footage or new hats, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess the first question for both of you is, do you think pre-ordering is dying out? You think it's a dying fad, or is it still has some relevancy?
Well, for me, I say that pre-orders have become something completely different, because especially with digital distribution, there is no limit, right? Maybe limited keys, but there's no limit to the actual game itself physically. The only one that you could maybe would argue that there should be, maybe you would pre-order, is collector's editions, because they might not last.
Yeah.
But overall, I think that a pre-order thing is used just pretty much as an incentive. So developers and publishers know exactly how much they're making, or how much, if they broke even and stuff just from the pre-orders alone. If that's the case, they're already making profit. And then they can start their plans on the next development of another iteration of the game, or a new venture entirely.
I think pre-ordering is more like in early stages of, like Ken said, like a limited edition of something. You know, sometimes limited edition things are like announced on the day, but pre-order, if they announce that, it kind of gets the hype going so that, you know, they'll be aware of it and more people will, you know, be waiting for, you know, when that something comes out, especially if it's like a limited edition item. So, you know, it would definitely raise the awareness of all the customers they'll have, and they'll make big profits off of that. I don't think it's going to go away.
Okay. Now, another part of the issue with pre-ordering is there's just so many games being released these days that to basically throw your money at a gamble at a $60 game does seem kind of foolish. And we've talked about this on earlier casts, that video games have depreciated in value. Thanks to indie developers releasing $5, $10 games, we got 99 cents games on the mobile devices, that it's very hard to, you know, justify spending $60 on just one video game. Especially spending $60 on one game 3-4 months in advance and you have no idea if it's going to be good or not.
Yeah, definitely. And again, that's why Spunkbee itself is a bit timid when it comes to, you know, profit or focusing on profits for the mobile market, because it is so competitive and there is so many games that come out and that everyone devalues their games and making it 99 cents. Even if they're really, really good at protection quality, making it 99 cents, you know, pretty much throws it back in your face and it gets lost in the flood.
And now AAA developers don't really have to worry about being lost in the flood because they're sort of priced in a completely different market compared to indie games. When you,
right.
Thanks to their extended funds and advertising, there's no chance you're not going to hear about the next Assassin's Creed or the next Call of Duty. But with that said, what we're seeing with a lot of people is that there's just less value in pre-ordering games these days, especially with DLC. We're seeing more games being released with DLC packs, day one DLC, and of course season passes. But they're basically asking you to spend $60 and then, you know, $15 to $20 on this extra stuff. And then there's always going to be the Game of the Year edition, which will then routinely go on sale, saving even more money. And it just seems less and less that you should buy a game on day one, and usually within a month or 2 months, the game will probably be $20, $30 cheaper.
Right. And the whole, and I think that's a new culture that we've created, right?
Yeah.
That sales market, something that wasn't really there before. It was more like we'll wait for used games. Mm-hmm. But now that people are actually putting things on sale at a higher frequency, people are doing that. I don't think it's in a frequency high enough to hurt the sales of a game, but I think that it's something that people just like people like clothes shopping. They like going to thrift stores, they like bargains. It's all about perceived value. Like, how much are you saving for something of whatever costs, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I think that the same thing applies with games. And again, I think that holding off or having those sales only. So most, especially indies, helps the developers, right? Because there is the concept of stagnation. And then sale can help, recoup their costs or put them over into the green.
Especially if your game gets on, a big sale, like the Steam holiday sales. I mean, even if your $10 game goes down to $2, you know that millions of people are going to be looking at that game and possibly buying it. So the sheer quantity outweighs, the initial price. But that's something that doesn't work for AAA developers, because when they're releasing a game at $60, they probably spend several million dollars just to develop it. So, when that game, if it drops down $3, $4 a copy, even if a lot of people buy it, it's not going to recoup that cost.
Right. And, it's if they ever do something or ever drop to that low, it's more like they're throwing it into an addition for another game, right?
Yeah.
If you buy this game, you get this game for $3, mm-hmm. right? You see that with Batman games recently, because it's like, buy this game, you get all three of them, but like, if you just buy them separately, they're really cheap already.
Now, it's interesting, talking about the sales mentality, is how digital stores have really adopted this as a very viable marketing strategy. We're seeing, stuff like Amazon, Steam, and of course, a site like Ken and I love, Green Man Gaming. They not only have holiday sales, they actually have pre-order sales. They will sell the game cheaper if you pre-order it compared to when it's actually released. I know with Green Man Gaming, Ken and I have bought new games $10, $15 cheaper than other stores because they offer like a 25% coupon on a game that's not even out yet.
Yeah, and they give you credit too, so you can actually use your credit dollars for other games too. Mm-hmm. And in fact, maybe get your next game for free.
And that is just pretty crazy. Again, that's one of the things I get to feel really old about, is I remember a time where there was no such thing as sales. You were spending $80 on a game and you were going to like it.
Right, because we had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the great thing about this market, is now, even though you could say it's getting flooded, we're also having a lot more choice.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you guys think about the season passes? Because this is another way that developers are trying to get people to buy content sight unseen.
That's more like faith in the developers, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, all the people that bought the season pass for Bioshock Infinite, the question is, it's a narrative-based game. Like, what are they going to add? What are they going to do? And I think that when I first came out, I was like, what a terrible idea to get this. Then I saw that they released the, what was the new one called?
Burial at Sea.
Burial at Sea. That looked excellent. So if they keep producing content like that, I think it might be worth it. But overall, I think season passes are a bad idea. The only one that I've seen that's done well or has a lot of cool stuff in it would be Borderlands 2.
But speaking of Borderlands 2, they have gotten some flack with how confusing they made it, because they've been releasing DLC that doesn't fit in the season pass. So they've got, a bunch of hats. They've been releasing these, like, mini story quests as well that I think they're, like, $2, $3 a pop. They released another level expander. They raised the level cap by like another 17 levels.
Mm-hmm.
But this stuff wasn't included in the season pass. And
I
know that kind of annoyed people. But on the other hand, they basically said day one that if you buy the season pass, you're getting the 4-story DLC. That's it. Line drawn. Nothing else.
Right. And when people think season pass, they think they're going to get all DLC.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, that is something that needs to be addressed too, and cleared. But they're one of the front runners that have done it, so we'll see. But I feel like it is a bit exploitative, right? Because you have like, oh, you have everything you need except for the psycho character. You have to buy that. I'm like, what? Yep.
And the level expanders.
Right. I'm like, great. $3 is wasted on some virtual levels that I don't need.
Now, here's something that I know, Ken, you've mentioned this before in terms of Kickstarter, but there's always the debate about Kickstarter, that is Kickstarter considered charity or is it considered pre-ordering? What do you think?
Both. Definitely both. Because, like, of all the games I've created or I've backed, I mean, I have received none of them yet. And I don't expect to get them for another year. And that's fine with me because I believe in the developers. Because I am funding it, I feel like I'm a part of the project now. So whatever they do, I hope they succeed, and hopefully my funds went in the right direction. And, you know, I see it as charity, definitely, but I also see it as a collaborator, too.
Will, what do you think about that?
That is a very tough question. I mean, I would consider it more like a pre-order, because I see it more prepared for, I guess, for people out there that sees the game and, you know, they're kind of anticipating for it. I mean, like Ken said, it'll be both in a way too, since I'm actually watching one of the Kickstarters, like Cryomore, and, you know, people don't donate money there for all these content too. So, yeah, I see it as both. And, you know, the people that donated early, they don't have to pay that much, and they get all this pretty nice stuff. Yeah, I see it as both.
I think I'm the same way. I see it as both. The games that I've done, of course, like Ken, they haven't been released yet. I just got a chance to play Planetary Annihilation. They opened up their beta this week. And it's pretty interesting, but it's still very much a rough game. They're pretty much saving, you know, accessibility and optimization for, like, the very last thing. So if you're not used to that type of game, it's very daunting and inaccessible at the moment.
I see. Well, the things that also, you know, there's a lot of things you can set aside, a lot of concessions you'll make because you funded it. You know it's really, really early, so you're fine with that when you're actually trying it out. In fact, you want to see if there's bugs so you can help fix it for them, so that no people in the future won't have to deal with it too.
I think another difference is the fact that it's a very lower cost point crowdfunding versus pre-ordering game. I mean, when you're outside giving, getting the extra rewards, you know, like the $100, $200 stuff, most games to pleasure them is $10, $15, stuff like that, versus a AAA game where the only way you're getting an early version of that game is if you spend $60 on it.
Mm-hmm. Right. But like I said, for this, it can range. You pay what you want, right?
Yeah.
Pay the minimum. And sometimes I actually help, in the end, actually increase the amount of pledge. Like, example, Abduction was going to not hit its stretch goal, so I put in $30 more or $20 more to get the art book and a bunch of other stuff too, get the main game, but also put them closer to the desired stretch goal that I wanted. I think that's why a lot of people see a ramp up at the last week, especially the last 3 days of the Kickstarter projects.
Yeah, and that's a whole strategy right there. We've heard people say that, like, the first week is very important for Kickstarter, as well as the last few days. That's usually the two big points of donations.
Right. And thinking back on it, there's some projects I just like missed out on, and I feel, like, example, the Omni Treadmill, I didn't fund because I was buying other stuff. But that's one of my regrets. So from now on, whenever I hear an announcement of a Kickstarter, I try to get there, like, on the hour to make sure I get early bird specials.
Yeah. And same here. And as we said, the price point for this is so small that for a lot of them, it does sort of hit the impulse buy for a lot of these is very strong, just to get you in the door. And then when you start seeing these stretch goals and you start getting excited, it sort of helps ease, you know, I already spent $8, what's, you know, $4 more. And then after that, okay, you know, they're really close to something I really want to get, I'll just give them a few more bucks. So it's better to sort of start low and rise and, you know, have it escalate versus having that very high price point and then lowering it little by little.
Right. So, I think there's a whole different mindset when it comes to Kickstarters and how to market it and pricing and costs. And I think one day we'll have a cast of a bunch of developers that have done Kickstarter and just get their opinion on everything.
Yeah, definitely like to do that. I know Chris Garner, who we've had on several times, his Kickstarter actually failed for Below, but he kept working on the game anyway. And he actually wrote an entire post on his site about the things he saw that he did wrong and what he would, you know, improve on in the future.
Yeah, I think Chris has a good experience of success and failure with Kickstarter. He has a varied opinion for sure.
Now, going back to AAA developers with pre-orders, another aspect, it's kind of funny that we still see AA developers like Atlus, This America. They do have some pretty good pre-order bonuses. They try to get you with, you know, the free art book, the free soundtrack. And I guess that's interesting that it's a way of giving it value, but at the same time, though, it's not content that's directly related to the game. In the sense that a soundtrack is not going to add new stuff to my game, or neither will an art book. In the same way that if someone puts out a DLC pack with new costumes or a new mission. So what do you guys think about those types of pre-order bonuses? Do you think they're still a useful marketing strategy?
I definitely think they are. I mean, if a game, especially if they offer a soundtrack, I love it. Even though I can easily pull it from the game, I'd rather just have an official soundtrack with the highest quality I can get. Along with an art book, too, to kind of see what they did with concept art, some original art design for some of the characters, maybe some background stuff, some interesting tidbits of whatever we pulled from it. But just kind of seeing a more of an intimate view of what they were doing when they were actually making the game. I think that still has validity. Now, game guides are stupid. People offer how to beat my game. Here's a game guide that comes with the game. Like, no, I don't want that. I want to explore. I want, don't try to undermine me.
What do you think, Will?
I mean, like Ken says, you know, I like the extra art, the you know, the soundtracks, maybe like a poster or something of, like, you know, if you had a world map, a poster of a world map, which would be pretty nice to hang on your, you know, your wall. And also, like, in a sense, if that game becomes really, really popular and all that stuff that you got was indeed limited, then that would be worth a lot of money.
Well, that's part of it, but you know, it's actually interesting. League of Legends, if you got the actual box copy of it, there's super rare skins within it. So now some of them go for sale for like $800.
And of course, when we speak about collector's editions and stuff and rarity, we can't leave out Blizzard. Blizzard has done, you know, amazing work with their collector's editions for their games. They were pretty much one of the few developers, even back then to this day, that make really great collector's editions. You can see quality of the boxes. They always have a little 10-page art book. They usually give like a full-blown hardcover book. I mean, I got my StarCraft II and my Diablo III box on display right behind me.
Right, and I think that's also a testament, too, of how much they care about their work, so.
And as we said, collector's editions, they pretty much nullify the complaint about pre-orders because they are, in fact, a limited number. I mean, very rarely, I mean, I can't even think of them, Ken or Will, do you know if anyone has ever reissued a collector's edition?
No.
Yeah, me neither. So that's pretty much how they retain their value. And of course, Blizzard, on top of that, has the quality and reputation that they've earned over the years. And even with that, I mean, even with other developers doing collector's editions. But I think that digital collector's editions sort of fall into that same issue of pre-ordering, because as we mentioned, when you have a digital copy of a game, there's an infinite amount. It's not only developers want to say, oh, we're all going to release 500 digital collector's keys for a game.
Right. So, I mean, I think that collector's editions are still going to be in demand in the future. I still think that people still like to have that kind of physical copy. But in terms of just the base, I don't think we need, you know, any sort of fanciful box or anything for it.
Yeah. Now, here's a question for both of you. In terms of pre-order bonuses, do you prefer games that have physical rewards? I just mentioned art, book, soundtrack, versus digital rewards, like additional costumes, or like they did with Borderlands 2, they had, you know, exclusive heads for people who pre-ordered the game for their characters.
I would like in-game rewards, but if I really enjoy the property, like let's say it was Dreamfall or Longest Journey, and they offered art book stuff, I would say hell yes to that over something within the game. I think it depends on the concept of the game or how much, you know, or what they actually offer you, or if you are, how much you actually see or control your avatar, etc., etc.
For me, it really depends on the rewards. Like, you know, in-game reward, like you said, costumes, something exclusive that you won't get, afterwards, or like, you know, soundtracks and stuff that's like physical, you know, I wouldn't mind getting those either. You know, they're they're nice assets to have.
Well, you just said the word exclusive, and that brings up another sort of debate about pre-order bonuses and DLC, and that's whether pre-order content should remain forever locked, or if it should be made available to the public for either free or as, you know, a $4 upgrade. Because we've seen cases where developers have sort of went back on that. For example, with Payday 2, they originally announced that exclusive gun, mask, and a sight would remain pre-order only. And then last month, they released a piece of DLC that's basically the pre-order bonus set. So they would basically, for $4 more, they'll give you those pre-order bonuses. And then there was the issue with Metro Last Light, I think the latest one, that there was this exclusive Ranger mode. It was supposed to be this super realistic, hardcore difficulty setting that was locked to pre-order only, and people raised hell about that, and they eventually released it as a DLC pack. So, what do you guys think about that? Should pre-order bonuses, exclusive content, should it remain exclusive, or should that eventually become available for purchase?
I think it should be available to purchase, right? That would be, I mean, especially Ranger mode is a good example of, like, people just were going crazy over not having that, because it's something they had in the original game, and it was the best way to play. And they advertise it as the way to play the game, which is pretty much putting your middle finger to your customer saying, this is what the full game was. Screw you guys. You have a paywall. Enjoy.
Or, you know, twisting that knife.
Exactly. But I think all DLC should be timed exclusives.
What do you think, Will?
I would probably agree with Ken, because, you know, having angry fans or, you know, it's not fun, because you get to deal with a lot more. You got to deal with letters. You got to deal with, like, you're putting pressure on, like, everyone in your team, sort of. So, you know, you want to kind of, like, appease the people. And also, you know, when you do add that later content as you know, extra money, as opposed to people that did pre-order it, you know, you're making profits for yourself. So you're making them happy. You're making yourself happy.
Now, what do you guys think about the complaint that people they basically say that by releasing exclusive content and making it, you know, purchasable by everyone, that it's sort of undervaluing the content? Because there's people out there who, you know, if an exclusive had in Team Fortress or whatever becomes easily accessible, they're going to say, you know, how dare you're cutting my profit, you're cutting the value of my item.
Well, I say you should do it because, you know, you piss up a small fraction of your audience, right, for the greater whole.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on the head price that you put on it. Like, I mean, if you really want to appease it, you can make it a little more expensive to their taste, but not too expensive that people won't buy it.
Now, I know we've been sort of going back and forth between pre-order and DLC because they really are, in a sense, connected, especially as more games are being released with day one content and stuff like that. Now, day one content has been shifted around a bit over the last few years. There was, of course, the original concept of Project $10, and this was a strategy by Activision and, I believe, EA, that they basically would lock content unless you bought the game new. And that was sort of the way of, you know, saying either you buy the game brand new, you don't buy a used copy, or you give us extra money. Now, Day 1 DLC is also another interesting idea because a lot of it is considered pre-order content. You know, you buy the game new, you buy first day, we'll give you new quests and stuff like that. And that raises another question for both of you. In terms of pre-order bonuses or pre-order content along those lines, do you think having sizable content, you know, removed from the game as a pre-order, do you think that is justified or smart business sense?
Well, that's a controversial subject, DLC, day one. There's a couple reasons why they do it. Of what you're saying, right, about incentive to pre-order the game and make sure that, you know, you have a legit customer, that there's that benefit. But, you know, the reason why, and I think what consumers don't understand is I think that, hey, why are they holding things from us that we should have day one? Why they cut part of the game out to put it, you know, as an extra download for more money? That's not always the case. Sometimes it's obvious, like Mass Effect 3, but most of the times, it's because eventually a game has to go gold, right? You have to say, this is it. This is our base game. We're not touching it. It's over, right? And in the meantime, what do you do with all your artists? What do you do with all your programmers? Do you need them? Do you throw them right on another project? Or maybe you can use their times to create more DLC for the game or add something cool that they always wanted for the game. And so between the gold the game going gold and the actual release date, they can actually create content for it, which will then help, you know, make the game succeed, or in giving them additional streams so they can make more games in the future and keep that team together. And I believe that after a month, the DLC purchase rates actually decline severely, huge steep. So you want to catch them earlier than later.
Think I'm out of questions. Do you guys have anything else you want to add about pre-orders?
No, I just think that it's good because this is more like my final say on it. It's good in terms of making sure that the developers can make their money back from development alone and see how I'll give them an assessment of how well they're doing. And also ensuring that they'll be able to produce more games in the future, because again, they're trying to even out their costs. But it also gives more of a hype to the consumers that love their product, right? It gives them more of an incentive to buy it. It gives them something to brag about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's also that. It's just when it's exploited, that's when it's bad. And the more and more games exploit the day one DLC or just DLC in general, less and less people are more inclined to actually buy it, right? They need to have the right perceived value. They want to make sure that it's an honest buy and that they're getting the bang for their buck, right?
What about you, Will? Do you have anything final you want to say?
Yeah, I don't think pre-orders are going to go away, and I don't think they should, because the hype's there, and like Ken says, you know, if you exploit it, it's going to go all hell. I mean, same with like a lot of other things too, but I mean, you know, doing it at you know at the right moment, as you said, perceived value, you know, people will be in there, and they'll definitely, you know, it'll benefit you, it'll benefit the people that are aware, you know, what's happening.
Right. I mean, it's the whole exploitation thing is similar to free-to-play too. One bad free-to-play game makes all free-to-play games look bad. One bad use of DLC will make all DLC look bad. So it's really up to the developers to really make sure that their choice and their decisions in terms of how they want to monetize their game is tasteful, right? And easily understood to the consumer. Stupid Ranger mode, dumb. That was a dumb decision.
Yeah.
They blamed on THQ, by the way,
Yeah, I heard that.
over Deep Silver, yeah.
And I guess for my final thoughts on it, I think that it still serves some purpose, but outside of, you know, the rare cases, you know, with super collector's editions, like, as we mentioned, Blizzard and those types of things, I think that the future really is going to be more towards, like, crowdfunding as the best pre-order. Because you're basically getting a deeper connection to the developer and the game than you would pre-order, you know, a $60, you know, Call of Duty or Madden or something like that.
Yeah, and but that and again, that's we'll see how that actually all turns out, because Kickstarter itself, even though there's still a lot of people, it's still not technically mainstream-ish enough, you know? So we'll see. But if they can grow their market and have a lot more of an audience for Kickstarter, it's a lot better for developers that are actually producing or going to release a game on their site. So we'll see. I'm very excited to see the future of crowdfunding, and I don't think there's going to be as much fatigue as everyone expects.
Yep, that's still a big top, and that's something that when we do have our Kickstarter discussion, we will have to bring that up, whether or not Kickstarter is actually a sustainable model or not.
I don't see why not. And I think Kickstarter is making mad cash right now. The site itself, they get 20% of everyone's offerings. It's
Oh, yeah.
ridiculous.
I bet they got a pretty nice paycheck with Double Fine and Project Eternity.
Right, exactly.
So, I think with that, we're going to wrap things up for this week's edition. Ken, Will, it was great talking to you tonight.
Got it.
And as always, for those of you listening, if you would like to be featured on the Game Wisdom podcast or write a piece for the site, feel free to send me an email. You can find all the information and guidelines under Submissions Wanted on the front page. So, with that said, thank you for listening to the Perceptive podcast this week. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.
Good night.